Welcome to Nowhere to Run with Christopher White.
Hey everyone, welcome to Nowhere to Run. My name is Chris. Thanks for tuning in. You can go to the website, which is nowheretorunradio.com, and you can email me at nowheretorun1984@gmail.com. Okay, in this episode, I'm going to do two different things. First thing I'm going to do is introduce you to something that I've been thinking about doing for a while, and that's kind of an apologetics sort of ministry, I guess you could call it. And, you know, there's a lot of apologetic sites out there, and they're really great. But I thought that it would be good to kind of translate a lot of that stuff to video and to do it in a real short way, in a complete way, taking some of the major questions, but also hitting some of the stuff that's not normally taken on by a lot of the apologetic sites, which is, you know, UFO type stuff and the kind of issues that we talk about with regularity here. But I haven't, you know, created a website or anything for it. I may later. But what it is available on is the New Revelations video podcast, which right now has pretty much all the videos that I've uploaded to my brand new YouTube channel on it, on iTunes. So if you go to iTunes and you type in, like, Revelations Video Network, I think, there's also a link to it on the front page of revelationsradionetwork.com. There's a link there that Frank has figured out a way to add the RSS of the YouTube channel to iTunes, and so you can download all of my videos in one shot there, and it's a great way to be able to do that, and it's like, you know, that's just really cool. So if you go to iTunes, if you're big on the video podcast, you can get all my videos in one shot, I guess in Flash Video or MP4. I don't know what format they're in, but all you have to do is type Revelations Video Podcast into the network. And I think that we're also going to be adding all the other stuff there, too. I mean, I'm sure the feed to Frank's channels is also there, included in that feed, as well as the new Frank and Chris video, which we haven't really done, but just one of those. But hopefully we'll get back on that very soon. Got shaken up after the whole Michael Tesorian debacle, of which I don't think I updated on the podcast last time, but he did. He, like, released all my personal information from the YouTube legal document that I was forced to give him in order to counter the claims, which YouTube eventually sided with me with one of the videos, and several others are pending right now. I'm sure that they'll side with me on those too, but it's just a lengthy process, so. But the original YouTube site will probably be down for a long, long time, because as soon as it was taken back, put it back up, Michael Tesorian then claimed copyright infringement on, like, I don't know, like 18 different videos. So it's going to be forever before that one gets back up. But thankfully, the new one, Nowhere to Run, KNOW 1984, is up. So in the process, I discussed that in a video called Michael Tesorian Gone Wild, and that's the update for that. For more information on that, I also added that as a video response to a video where Alex Jones's YouTube page has just been shut down for the same basic thing. People claiming copyright on things. In his case, I think they were claiming copyright on them showing news reports and things like that. And not even video, like pictures of news articles from websites. So anyway, so there is a lot of buzz about YouTube, about people taking down a lot of channels that have been talking, at least from a Christian perspective, about all these things. It's probably in other areas too, but that one for sure that I know of. So anyway, let me play the 10-minute clip from the first Neo Apologetics installment. This one was to something that's a pretty common question that is asked, which is, did Jesus say that he would return within the apostles' lifetime? And I've had this question asked a lot of times. It's been one that I've been meaning to address for a while, but actually ended up having to do a lot more research because I started questioning whether or not the thing that I usually had said to that was true. So I ended up doing a lot of research for this, and I learned a lot of things that I didn't know before about it. So I'll play the audio from this. It's about 10 minutes long, and I'll see you on the other side of it. A common question that people have is about a statement that Yeshua made to his disciples when he said, "Truly I say to you, there are some standing here who shall not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." This is also mentioned in other passages in Luke chapter 9 and in Mark chapter 9. Some people, when quoting this, fail to quote the passage as it reads. Instead, they claim Jesus said that some of his disciples wouldn't die until he returns, or something similar. But what we read is that they would not taste death until they see the kingdom of God, or they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. And this is what happened 6 days later when Jesus, or Yeshua, took three of his closest disciples, Peter, James, and John, up to a mountain to witness what I think is one of the strangest and least understood events in the Bible. It is sometimes called the Transfiguration. One of the reasons that this event is not usually linked with the preceding verse that says, "There are some standing here who shall not taste of death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom," is because the next verse, which starts, "And after 6 days," begins another chapter. Here it is important to realize that the chapter divisions are not necessarily inspired. The chapter divisions used today were developed by Stephen Langton, an Archbishop of Canterbury. Langton put the modern chapter divisions into place around A.D. 1227. What is interesting is that in all three places this is told in the Bible, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, there is a difference in the chapter divisions at this point. Most notable is the book of Mark. It is generally agreed that the book of Mark was written by Mark using the testimony of the Apostle Peter, who is one of the three people who witnessed this strange event. In that book, the chapter begins with, "Truly I say unto you, there are some of those standing here," which implicitly links the Transfiguration to that event. But in the book of Luke, there are no chapter divisions in sight on either side of the verse. So in all three cases, the chapter divisions are in vastly different places. One biblical commentator said it this way: "The above verse is the closing one of Matthew 16, and it is exceedingly unfortunate that a chapter division has been made to immediately follow it, and thus obscure its real meaning to many readers. What follows in the next chapter is the fulfillment of Christ's promise to the disciples, as is clear from the opening statement, 'And after 6 days, Jesus taketh Peter, James, and John, his brother, and bringeth them up into a high mountain apart, and was transfigured before them.' The 'and,' connecting Matthew 17 and chapter 16, the 'after 6 days,' dating from the promise given the disciples, and the 'some,' finding its fulfillment in Peter, James, and John. Here, then, is the key to the significance of the Transfiguration scene. It was the disciples seeing the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. It was a pattern and a sample of the glory in which our Lord shall return to the Mount of Olives. It was a visible representation, a spectacular setting forth of each of the leading elements which shall be found in Christ's millennial kingdom. The author then goes on to, quote, particularize and detail these specific events. So let us also look into the details to see if this event can be seen as a type of kingdom of God. First, I want to point out that these three men weren't the first humans to get a glimpse of the kingdom of God. The Old Testament prophet Daniel also saw the coming of the kingdom of God. He says so expressly. Also take note that when Daniel saw this event, he makes some similar observations that other people will later make regarding the appearance of Christ in his kingdom. "As I looked, thrones were placed, and one that was Ancient of Days took his seat. His raiment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came forth from before him. 1,000,000 served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the cloud of heaven there came out one like a Son of Man, and he came to the Ancient of Days, and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed." The Ancient of Days' hair in Daniel is described as pure wool, and his raiment as white. Interestingly, it's described this way also by the Apostle John when he got a glimpse in a vision of a man who identified himself as the resurrected Jesus Christ. It says in Revelation 1, verse 16, "And his hairs were white like wool, and white as snow, and his eyes were as a flame of fire, and his feet like unto fine brass, as if they burned in a furnace. And his voice was the sound of many waters. And he had in his right hand 7 stars, and out of his mouth went a sharp-tongued sword, and his countenance was as the sun shineth in his strength." Here we again find more clues. John also describes the face of Jesus as extremely bright in this state, but he also describes his eyes as flames of fire. Again, we go back to Daniel. In Daniel, He also spoke of the brightness of the face in Daniel 10, verse 6. His body was like a beryl, and his face as the appearance of lightning, and his eyes lamps of fire, and his arms and his feet like the color to polished brass, and the voice of his words like the voice of a multitude. The disciples in the Transfiguration were favored with a glimpse of Christ in his resurrection glory, and apparently he is extremely bright in this resurrected state. Just ask Saul, who was blinded by the effects of Christ's glory as manifested to Saul of Tarsus on the Damascus Road. And here are a few parallels in the Transfiguration event that show that the disciples not only witnessed the Messiah as he truly is, but that they are also witnessing a very detailed description of the prophesied kingdom of God. And behold, there appeared unto them Moses and Elijah talking with them. From the fact that Moses, representative of the law, and Elijah, standing for prophets, were with Christ at this time, we may learn that the Old Testament saints shall have their part and place with Christ in his millennial kingdom. There is also another fact revealed here. When the Lord returns to the earth, he will be accompanied by two classes of saints, here represented by Moses and Elijah, namely those who have passed through death and those who have been changed. The three disciples, Peter, James, and John, may be regarded as representatives of the church. During the Transfiguration, Jesus, Moses, and Elijah are wearing white garments, the same kind that the redeemed will wear. While he yet spoke, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and behold, a voice came out of the cloud which said, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Hear ye him." The mention of the bright cloud here is deeply significant, the more so as it was out of it that the voice of God was heard speaking. This was the cloud which had been withdrawn from Israel centuries before, but which now suddenly appeared again. This was the cloud in which Jehovah appeared of old, the cloud of the Shekinah glory. It was the cloud which filled the tabernacle, the cloud that covered the tent of the congregation, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle in Exodus 40. This was the cloud that guided Israel through their wilderness wanderings. This was the cloud in which Jehovah appeared in the Holy of Holies upon the mercy seat. This is the cloud which filled the temple of Solomon. Little wonder that the disciples fell on their faces and were sore afraid. The appearing of the Shekinah cloud on the Mount of Transfiguration was the intimation that it shall be visible to Israel again in the millennial kingdom. That it will be is further evident from a prophecy in Isaiah 4, verse 5. The sequel of the Transfiguration was equally wonderful in its typical signification, in that the first thing that Jesus did after he came down from the Mount of Transfiguration was cast out the demon that his disciples could not cast out. And so also, in perfect typology, the first thing that he will do when he returns to earth is to cast out Satan and to secure him during the millennial Sabbath before destroying him completely. There is another interesting parallel, but to get to it, we must first understand what appears to be a contradiction. Both Matthew and Mark recorded the period between Jesus saying that some standing here wouldn't taste death until the Transfiguration event as 6 days, but Luke mentions that the delay was actually 8 days. I'm reminded here of a quote from one of my favorite lecturers, Chuck Missler, who says, "Thus we discover that every detail in the Bible is there by design. This insight opens an entirely new dimension of Bible study. Every time you find a, quote, mistake or, quote, contradiction in the Bible, rejoice. There is a discovery behind that ostensible discrepancy." Matthew and Mark, who are both Jews, recorded time differently than Luke, who was a Greek. Luke included the beginning of that day and the rest of the last day. This is also why Luke is the only one to use the approximation when telling of the length of the days. He says it took about 8 days. But I also believe that the detail is there for a reason, and I think it is because it helps us recognize that the event may have taken place on a Sabbath, and if so, it would be yet another illustration of the millennial Sabbath and the kingdom of God. I'll conclude with this point. Peter himself refers to the event of the Transfiguration as a sample of Jesus' coming. He says, "For we have not followed cunningly devised fables when we have made known unto you the power and the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but were eyewitnesses of his majesty. For he received from God the Father honor and glory when there came such a voice to him from the excellent glory, 'This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased.'" Thanks for your time.
Russ Dizdar explains his ministry, Shatter the Darkness.
Almost 20 years now, we've been just kind of just trying to help people, minister to people, share with people coming out of cults, you know, just mind control, the occult, left-hand path stuff. And then we ran into the real underground that's been going on for a long time. And so it has a lot to do with deliverance and dealing with the dark side and power encounters. And, you know, it has confronting perpetrators of violence on children and ritual abuse. It deals with healing the hearts of the victims and, you know, keeping our guard and trying to do what we can to expose it, stop some of it.
You can visit Russ Dizdar's website at shatterthedarkness.net, where you'll find hours of free MP3s and podcasts, as well as courses for your church or your ministry to begin to learn how to deal with encounters of this nature in a biblical way. Shatterthedarkness.net.
Okay, everybody, this next part is really important if you're really interested in the things that I talk about when I'm talking about the kind of Bill Cooper mystery religion and how it affects us today with these people like Jordan Maxwell, Michael Tsarian. And if you know a lot about those people and you know what they teach and you've been around the block, so to speak, in that arena, or if you've studied it from the other side, as far as, you know, Bill Cooper and Fritz Springmeier, Stan Monteith, those kinds of things, then you're going to be really interested in this next presentation. It was done so well. It's done by probably my favorite researcher, which is Chris Pinto. Chris is the guy who did Riddles and Stone, the movie, and he did Megiddo, and he's got a new one called The Eye of the Phoenix, The Secret of the Dollar Bill. He also did one, Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings, The New Atlantis, Volume 1. The presentation that I'm about to play for you is something that he did as part of Radio Liberty with Stan Monteith, where he did a PowerPoint presentation about what he calls the Atlantis Connection. And if you've noticed the preoccupation with Atlantis and the truth movement, teachers and things like that, you'll find this extremely interesting. This is not just a connection, I think it's a key to unlocking a lot of what's going on. And even if you're somebody that feels like you know a lot of this stuff, you're going to get a lot out of this presentation. So it's about an hour and 20 minutes long, so, you know, find some time when you can listen to it. But I highly recommend it, and I think you'll enjoy Chris Pinto and see why I think he's probably one of the prominent researchers today. A really good interview I heard with him recently was on Future Quake Radio, which is a new show on the Revelations Radio Network, and I highly recommend that as well. So here is Chris Pinto and his presentation called The Atlantis Connection.
Well, Chris, it's time. Without further ado, Chris Pinto.
Okay, well, I'm really glad to be here. Thank you, Dr. Stan, for inviting me. And the name of the documentary that we produced and we released back in February of this year is called Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings, Volume 1, The New Atlantis. And what I want to talk to you about today is something I call the Atlantis Connection. And this is something that I've been researching for a number of years. Some of you may have seen another couple of documentaries that I produced and directed a few years ago called Megiddo, The March to Armageddon, Part 1 and 2. And this was something that I actually wanted to talk about in the Megiddos, but it was such a vast topic, I chose to leave it alone and wait for the Lord to present another opportunity. And I really believe that Secret Mysteries is that opportunity. So the Atlantis Connection, this is what the presentation is about. What I wanted to start with was to play a clip from the documentary, which is a short preview clip. Are we ready? All right. We're going to play this real quick. It's like a 90-second clip, but then I want to talk about the clip as soon as it plays. And are we ready? Here we go.
You understand that America was founded by Christians as a Christian nation. However, there were always those people on the other side who wanted to use America, use our military power and our financial power to establish enlightened democracies throughout the world and restore lost Atlantis.
When our founders declared a new order of the ages, they were acting on an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled.
As America marches forward, spreading democracy throughout the globe, is she merely promoting freedom or fulfilling an ancient plan? Is she following a course planned for centuries by men who believe she is chosen for a secret destiny? To understand understand the present and possibly the future, we look into the past as we unfold the secret mysteries of America's beginnings. Can America be the new Atlantis?
That's a preview clip that we show, and that's toward the beginning of the documentary. Of course, you got to see Dr. Stan there, who does a great job throughout the film if you haven't seen it. And he really encapsulates, I feel like, what we're talking about. Part of the question, probably one of the central questions that we ask as we were making the film, we all know that this debate goes on today. If you watch popular media, it happens all the time. It's a very popular subject in churches and so on. And that's the issue of America's founding. Was America founded as a Christian nation? And so the question that we ask is, if America was founded as a Christian nation only, then why is it that the chief symbols of our nation are these Egyptian, Greco-Roman, Babylonian mystery symbols? Why do we have the Statue of Liberty patterned after the Babylonian mother goddess of the ancient world? Why do we have the Washington Monument that was specifically designed as an Egyptian obelisk? And we're going to talk about that when we get into Volume 2. Why do we have this all-seeing eye, the Eye of Horus, perched over a truncated pyramid on the back of the U.S. dollar bill? And so the series attempts to answer the question, where do these things come from? And that's what we intend to do as we go through all four parts. But I specifically in that clip wanted to draw your attention to President Bush's statement in his second inaugural address, where he talks about when our founders declared a new order of the ages, that they were acting on an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled.
When our founders declared a new order of the ages, they were acting on an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled.
What is the ancient hope that President Bush is referring to? And that's another question that we attempt to answer as we make our way through Secret Mysteries Volume 1. And I believe, and there's, if you read esoteric wisdom philosophers and teachers and so on, this ancient hope is the idea that there has been a plan, an ambition, contained within secret societies for thousands of years to resurrect the lost empire of Atlantis. And for those who don't know, the whole idea of the new Atlantis and the new world order and the new order of the ages are, if you read the writings of these societies, they are all one and the same thing. So the Atlantis story begins with the Greek philosopher Plato. And so you go back and Plato has this dialogue called the Critias. And in it, this is the earliest written account of the story of Atlantis. But what's very interesting is that Plato, through his characters, is making reference to an ancient Greek lawgiver, a guy named Solon. And Solon was, to the ancient Greeks, kind of like what Moses was to the Israelites. And that'll make more sense in a minute. But anyway, there's this ancient Atlantis dialogue that took place where this story is being recounted. It's called the Critias. And it's a dialogue where there's a young man named Critias who is sharing a story about this ancient empire known as Atlantis. And Plato goes out of his way in the dialogue to make the point that the story is not a fiction, but that it's a reality. Okay, and people have debated about this for centuries. Was Plato just coming up with this allegorical myth, or is there anything in reality to the idea of Atlantis? And because Solon is the character that's being referred to, the story itself is given a lot of weight and prominence. Now we come to a picture of our Supreme Court building. Now this is on the reverse of the U.S. Supreme Court building, on the back side. And there you see, on this tympanum, in the center you've got Moses, okay, chiseled in stone, and he's holding the Ten Commandments, one on either side. And then to Moses' right, you have Confucius. And then on Moses' left, holding up what looks like a set of scrolls or whatever, you have Solon. the Greek philosopher. This is why I say Solon is kind of like the Greek version of Moses. Then you go to the House of Representatives, and you find a carved bust of Solon in the House of Representatives. This brings us to a guy who's really the central focus, probably, if I had to pick one character. The central focus of Secret Mysteries Volume 1 is Sir Francis Bacon. And in 1626, Bacon passed away a year later after he died. Those who were a part of what is called the Baconian Circle, a lot of his followers, they published his final work, and it was a book called The New Atlantis. Now, what's very interesting is that when Plato wrote his Atlantis dialogue, it moves along and it builds up to this big climax and this crescendo, and then suddenly it stops. And the story doesn't have an ending. So now in Bacon's New Atlantis, you have the same thing. The story, it's basically, in a nutshell, it's the story of these Christian sailors who are lost at sea, and they come across this lost or this hidden island called Bensalam. And they go into the land of Bensalam, and they've never seen this place before, and they encounter this really advanced culture, and they're not sure what to make of it or what the proper customs are and so on. And then they meet one of the leaders of the House of Bensalam, or not the House of Bensalam, it's one of the leaders of Bensalam, and it's called the House of Solomon. And Solomon, many Baconian writers and scholars believe, is a code name for Sir Francis Bacon. Bacon wrote about, in his own writings, he wrote about imitating the work of King Solomon. And it's based upon the proverb, the idea that it is the glory of God to conceal a thing, but the honor of kings is to search out a matter. So Bacon latched on to this idea, and he writes about it specifically. He latched on to this idea, and he said, well, I'm going to do a bunch of work in secret. And this is essentially what he did. Now, he has a lot of work that he did and that he published openly, but he was specifically known for developing work in secret. And he was the head during the Elizabethan era. This is about the time of Queen Elizabeth I, late 1500s, going into the 1600s, through Elizabeth I, and then King James I, who authorized the King James Bible. And under King James, Bacon would become the Lord High Chancellor of England, the Keeper of the Great Seal. So he arose to a position of great prominence in England, and then he was suddenly disempowered at one point because he was accused of taking a bribe, and that's a whole big controversy. And King James would not allow him to defend himself. He was deposed as Chancellor of England, spent a few days in the Tower, had to pay a minor fine, and then he was released. And there's been all kinds of speculation as to why that happened. But he was a very prominent character during this Elizabethan era. Now, what's interesting is that Bacon, in his time, America had already been discovered. Bacon believed, as many of his contemporaries, that America, that the continent of America, was the site of ancient Atlantis. Not just a metaphor for Atlantis, not just a symbol for Atlantis, but that it was literally, physically, the Atlantean continent that had been rediscovered. Okay, and he writes in his book, The New Atlantis, he says, "And the great Atlantis that you call America, of all this there is with you sparing memory or none, but we have large knowledge thereof." Now he's writing about this, really, Bensalam and this House of Solomon is a secret society, symbolically, because they talk about, the leader of Bensalam talks about how their society observes all things, but they are known by no one. Not only that, there's a very telling phrase here when he says, "Of all this there is with you sparing memory or none." In other words, you don't know anything about Atlantis, but we have large knowledge thereof. Now it becomes very telling when you realize that the ancient mystery religion, which is essentially what all of the secret societies believe in and practice, and that's the whole god and goddess worship of Egypt and Babylon and Greece and Rome, the whole pantheon of pagan gods, that is the belief system in general of the secret societies. Well, if you talk to these people who believe in and practice these things, they will tell you that all of the ancient mystery traditions go all the way back to Atlantis. And they believe that the first great king of Atlantis was Enoch. Okay? Enoch, the seventh from Adam, as we read in the Bible. You know, and Enoch walked with God, it says, and was not, for God took him. That Enoch. They believe because Atlantis is the antediluvian world, the pre-flood world. And of course, Atlantis being destroyed by a massive tidal wave, supposedly from the gods who were angry with the Atlantean kings, many people believe that Atlantis is simply another flood story. Well, in the occult, in among those who practice and believe esoteric wisdom, they believe that Enoch was the first great king and also the first initiator of the mysteries. And so he initiated, supposedly, people into the ancient mystery religion. And so all the mysteries, so Atlantis plays a very important role when you're researching the mysteries, and of course the mystery religion is essentially the New Age religion. It's essentially the same belief system that has evolved and developed and so on for the New Age movement. Now, what's very interesting is that Bacon is not the only guy who believed that America was Atlantis. There are people who are New Agers, who are practitioners of New Age theology, who believe that Atlantis is America today, that believe that this is the continent, this is the site of ancient Atlantis. One of them is Dr. Robert Hieronymus. And we talk about Dr. Hieronymus in Secret Mysteries. Hieronymus wrote this book, America's Secret Destiny. Okay? And he's writing about a lot of the founding fathers, and he writes about them in a very esoteric manner. Hieronymus is considered to be the foremost expert on the Great Seal of the United States, that all-seeing eye with the eagle and so on the back of the dollar bill. His research has been used by the White House, by the State Department, by the Department of the Interior. Years ago, when Anwar Sadat was still alive, Sadat wanted to know about the Great Seal. What does it mean? Why? He saw the Egyptian pyramid on there and he thought, wow, maybe this has something to do with Egypt. So he went about trying to find out, and he was given Dr. Hieronymus's doctrinal thesis as an explanation. Well, Dr. Hieronymus believes, and we interviewed him, you're going to see him in Volume 2, if you see Secret Mysteries 2 on Washington, D.C., we interviewed Dr. Robert Hieronymus. For that as well. And he holds this view. Likewise, Benjamin Krem from Share International. Benjamin Krem just spoke at the United Nations in July of this year. Spoke to an NGO group at the UN. Then he came to speak to some groups, or at least one group, out in Los Angeles. While he was in Los Angeles being interviewed, he made mention of the fact that he believed that this continent, he said, right here where we are, this is the site of ancient Atlantis. And so this whole concept of resurrecting lost Atlantis, which is part of, I don't know if you could hear it in the opening quote from Dr. Stan, but he's talking about, you know, to spread this philosophic or democratic commonwealth around the world and rebuild lost Atlantis. And this is a recurring theme throughout the occult. Now, it's interesting, in the New Atlantis, Bacon writes, he says, at that time, he's talking about in ancient times, this land was known and frequented by the ships and vessels of all the nations before named. And then he talks about the Phoenicians, the Tyrians, the Carthaginians, the Egyptians, the Chinese, and the Palestinians. Okay, so he's talking about ancient Atlantis, and he's talking about how Atlantis, which now at the time that he's writing, is but full of junks and canoes, he said. He's referring to the Indians, you know, who went about in canoes. And he says, but at one time, they abounded with these tall ships, and they had trading with throughout the world and so on. Well, one of the things that we talk about in Secret Mysteries toward the end is a book by a Harvard professor, and the book is called America BC. Now, America BC describes, this is from the back cover, it says, America BC describes ancient European temple inscriptions from New England and the Midwest that date as far back as 800 BC. This is Fells, Barry Fell. This is like his magnum opus. This was his great work as an archaeologist. And he wrote about this. He documented for years. And I'll show you some of the pictures that he has in his book. The big picture there with all the coins, those are Roman coins that were found in the 4th century AD off the coast of Vermont. Okay? Then he's got different travelers that are carved in the upper, the upper right-hand corner. These are some of the different travelers. They're images that were discovered in the New Hampshire, Vermont areas. Below, he's got this figure there just below that. And the caption up above, you probably can't read it, but it says, the Druids of New England. And so he's talking about the Druids coming to the New England area centuries and centuries long before Columbus supposedly discovered America. We find Baal worship in early America. This is a place called Mystery Hill in New Hampshire. It's just outside the town of Salem. And there you've got the caption below reads, this larger image refers to a Beltane stone. Beltane is a holiday that's practiced today by witches. And Beltane is a holiday that celebrates and glorifies the god Bel or Baal. Bel and Baal are one and the same. On the other side, you have two images. One of them is a cast, and they've outlined in white the Eye of Bel, or the Eye of Baal. And if you can see the image just below that, the similarity between the Eye of Baal and the all-seeing eye of the Egyptians is startling. You study the Eye of Horus, or the Eye of Osiris, throughout ancient Egypt. But here this is found centuries and centuries prior to the discovery of the New World by Columbus. Now this is a place, not to be confused, this is called America Stonehenge. This is Mystery Hill. Now, in one of our other documentaries, we talk about the Georgia Guidestones, and that's called sometimes the American Stonehenge. Well, there's actually a website you can go to for Mystery Hill, and they call it, quote, America's Stonehenge. And you can actually go there today and take a tour of America's Stonehenge. And again, it's near the town of Salem in New Hampshire, and this is from one of their magazines. It says, quote, inscribed tablets of the ancient Canaanite god Baal, Celtic god Bel, have been found on this site. Worshippers of Baal were associated with fertility rites, sun worship, and human sacrifice. I was pretty surprised to find that, but it's on the internet today. Now, one of the guys who really, probably the driving force through the 20th century to really encapsulate and to define the whole idea of Atlantis and America and the connection between them, was Manly P. Hall. Manly P. Hall is considered by most of the esoteric wisdom teachers and even people who have come out of that as being probably the leading occult philosopher throughout the 20th century. He founded an organization in the 1930s called the Philosophic Research Society. In fact, I used to live about a mile away from PRS, as it's called. I didn't know it until I started doing the research for this documentary. And I had actually ordered a couple of Hall's books online. And I got one of his books, and I flipped it over, and it said, published by the Philosophic Research Society. And it gave the address, Los Feliz Boulevard, and I said, oh my gosh, that's right down the road. So I ended up going there and actually took a tour of their library and had an opportunity to interview and speak with the president of PRS. That was a very interesting conversation. And of course, anything that you would ever read about the New Age and the hatred of Christianity and so on will be confirmed if you sit down with one of these guys and have a conversation with him. He took great pride in telling me, I didn't let him know that I was a Christian. Until after I had talked to him. But when I was interviewing him, he went out of his way and took great pride in telling me that the Bible was the only book that had ever been written by losers, quote unquote. Okay? These guys have a bitterness toward Christianity. It's very real. It's not just something you read about in books. I've interviewed a number of these guys. In fact, for Secret Mysteries, you know, in the documentaries I've done previous, I almost always just interview Christian speakers and teachers and writers and so on. For this, because we're trying to show people in different ways what this movement is really all about, we've sought out interviews with some of the guys who really believe in and teach these things. And it is it's often a jaw-dropping experience. Anyway, Hall, the reason he's significant, one of the reasons, is because when he passed away, the Scottish Rite Journal, which is the leading Masonic publication in the country, it's based in Washington, D.C. In Washington, D.C., you have the Masonic House of the Temple. Okay? And I'll just give you a little bit of information. This is something from Volume 2. The guy who designed the Masonic House of the Temple was hired, was commissioned. He was a total New Age guy who designed the Masonic House of the Temple in D.C. And because his design was so successful, he was then hired to design all of these other major buildings throughout D.C. It's very interesting. But anyway, the Scottish Rite Journal referred to Hall. They made mention of the fact that he was, quote, often referred to as Masonry's greatest philosopher. Scottish Rite Journal, 1990. Now, what's interesting about this, Dr. Stan made mention that the History Channel, and the History Channel has actually had several documentaries where they are interviewing a lot of leading Masons. A lot of these guys, one of the guys that they interview, I've seen him in at least two documentaries, is named Brent Morris. Brent Morris, thank the Lord, we got an interview with for Riddles in Stone, which is coming up here, Lord willing, soon. And Brent Morris not only has spoken on the History Channel, he's the managing editor for the Scottish Rite Journal. Okay? They don't tell you that on the History Channel, but I think it's pretty significant. He also has published several books. The Masons are, somehow or other, they're really on the move right now. They've published several books confronting a lot of the anti-Masonic theories and teachings and things like that. And they're being very aggressive about it. They're coming out and they're talking about a lot of these hard issues and Luciferian worship and stuff like this. Because it seems, as much as I can figure out, that they're really trying to clean up their image, but they're often defending the indefensible. And one of the things is Manly P. Hall. And they try to get away from Hall, but they have such a hard time, and you'll see when I show you the interview in Riddles in Stone, how Brent Morris dances around the fact that the Scottish Rite Journal called Manly Hall Masonry's greatest philosopher. Okay? And the reason they want to deny Hall is because Hall tells you in the Lost Keys of Freemasonry that when the Mason truly understands the secrets of his craft, then will he hold the seething energies of Lucifer in his hands. That's what they're trying to get away from. But here's what Hall had to say about the whole idea of America and Atlantis. He says, quote, thousands of years ago, these mystical orders, he's talking about secret societies, were aware of the existence of the Western Hemisphere and the great continent which we call America. The bold resolution was made that this Western continent should become the site of the philosophic empire. And this is what Sir Francis Bacon, according to Hall and other Baconian authors, was all about. The reason Bacon is significant is because he sent his secret societies to America early on. In fact, it's believed that that the Jamestown colony probably had representatives or guys in it who were sent by Bacon specifically. One of the early settlements in America is in the town of Ephrata, the Ephrata Cloister, which is in Pennsylvania. It's right near or right about Lancaster, Pennsylvania. I was there a couple of months ago. It's kind of a funny story. I was in Lancaster, Pennsylvania speaking, and I was talking about this, and I was telling them about the Ephrata Cloister, and I had no idea. They all knew. They're all sitting there looking at me like I'm an idiot because they knew it was right down the road. And I'm standing there talking about it like they'd never heard of it before. But it was originally a Rosicrucian settlement, and it's there today. okay? A Rosicrucian settlement. So these are two of Hall's books that I wanted to draw your attention to. One, the one that has kind of a white background, The Secret Teachings of All Ages. This is Hall's great magnum opus. This is why many people believe he is the great occult wisdom teacher of the 20th century, because he basically dedicated his whole life to going all over the world and gathering all of the esoteric occult wisdom teachings and philosophies from all the traditions. And he compiled them in this book, The Secret Teachings of All Ages. And if you go get a copy, it's like this huge book. But he teaches in there everything from Masonry to Rosicrucianism to Kabbalah to literally telling you how you can draw a pentagram on the floor and conjure up a demon and make a pact with Lucifer. Okay? He's actually got that in his book. He gives you a couple of different kind of pacts that you can make with the devil once you summon him. So that's The Secret Teachings of All Ages. His other book, The Secret Destiny of America, is the one where he really goes into a lot of detail about America's founding from the perspective of these esoteric occult societies. And I just want to reiterate, because some people get the wrong idea or the wrong impression when I talk about these things, but I want to reiterate what Dr. Stan said earlier. I definitely acknowledge, and so does David Bay, who worked with me on this, that Christians certainly came to America early on and have played a very important role in the founding and the development of America. But the conflict that we see in America today, from what I've studied, is not a conflict that began in the 1960s, as many people think. It's a conflict that has been here right from the beginning. In fact, if you read the writings of William Bradford, who came over on board the Mayflower and was the chief governor of the Plymouth colony for like 30 some odd years. He wrote a history of the Plymouth plantation. If you read his history, he talks about very early on a neighboring colony that erected a maypole, okay? And they were getting drunk and bringing in the Indian women, and they were dancing about it in these pagan ceremonies. And he talks about how it looked as though they were resurrecting the bizarre orgies of the Bacchanalia. And so he had an awareness. It's very clear. And that's the Bacchanalia, this worship of Bacchus, the ancient god, Bacchus. And he talks about how fornication and adultery and homosexuality even were being practiced by people there right in early America, back in the 1600s. And Bradford is writing about this stuff. So what part of the point that we try to make is not to deny the Christian heritage of America, but to acknowledge that this conflict has been around right from the beginning. And that while, yes, there were Christians who came here and they wanted to build their churches and they wanted to worship the Lord and preach the gospel, and I'm certainly very thankful that they did, but they were not alone. There were other people who came here and they had a completely different idea about what America was supposed to be. And that's really what Manly Hall is talking about in his book, The Secret Destiny of America. And he, if you watch, I actually got one of Hall's lectures. This is a guy who, he wrote some 200 books in his life. And he gave 8,000 lectures before he died. 8,000 lectures. And the president of the society told me that they still have, when he died, they had a bunch of Freemasons that turned out for his funeral. Okay, they turned out, you know, in full honors and everything to come to honor what they called, quote, illustrious Manly P. Hall. And that the Masons still, to this day, he told me, they still go by PRS, the Philosophic Research Society, and talk about what a great, wonderful influence Manly Hall was. Hall was a sculptor, just to give you a little bit more insight. He only did 3 sculptures in his lifetime. One of them was of Mahatma Gandhi. The other one was of Madame H.P. Blavatsky. And the third one was of Albert Pike. Those 3. And then he said he was done. That's what the president told me anyway. So this is a quote from Hall in Secret destiny. He says, quote, the English program was under the direction of Sir Francis Bacon. He's talking about the Baconian societies and the influence of Bacon during the Elizabethan era. He says, the English program was under the direction of Sir Francis Bacon, and it was his genius that gave purpose to the enterprise. Bacon quickly realized that here in the New World was the proper environment for the accomplishment of his great dream, the establishment of the philosophic empire. And what Hall maintained and what he writes about is that Bacon sent these secret societies to the New World. And in chapter 13 of this book, the chapter heading is literally Bacon's secret society is set up in America. And now what you've got, I want to draw your attention to this picture that Hall publishes in this book. In the center, you've got Benjamin Franklin. Most people probably recognize him. You have Benjamin Franklin overlooking the eastern seaboard of the United States. Now, behind him is the shadow of Sir Francis Bacon, as though Bacon is influencing the decisions that Benjamin Franklin made. Now, we talk in Secret Mysteries about all that Ben Franklin did. Benjamin Franklin was a very high-ranking Freemason. He was most likely a Rosicrucian as well. And I'll talk more about Rosicrucianism here in a minute. He was most likely a Rosicrucian as well. He was the master of the lodge in Pennsylvania, here in America. He became the grand master of the lodge in Paris, France. He initiated Voltaire in France. Other members of that lodge were John Paul Jones and the Marquis de Lafayette, who fought with George Washington. Lafayette, when he came to America, brought with him a guy named Pierre-Charles L'Enfant. L'Enfant was the architect who designed the city layout for Washington, D.C. Okay, with all that in mind, so Benjamin Franklin is Grand Master of the Lodge in Pennsylvania, Grand Master of the Lodge in Paris, and he's a member of a secret group in England known as the Hellfire Club. And he was very good friends with a guy named Sir Francis Dashwood. And Dashwood was the founder of the Hellfire Club there in England. It was a very occult society that dedicated a lot of time to mocking Christianity and having all of these anti-Christian ceremonies and things like that. And they actually had a phrase written above the entrance, the entryway to the Hellfire Club, which went down into this underground area. And the phrase was, do what you will shall be the whole of the law. And what they were doing, this is centuries before the Satanist Aleister Crowley, which many of you will know if you've listened to Dr. Stan or if you've seen the video, They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. You know how nefarious Aleister Crowley was. Well, long before Crowley, there was the Hellfire Club. And they based the phrase on this radical, heretical French priest named François Rabelais, who wrote this series of books called Gargantua and Pantagruel. And there they have this society that's built up, and it's called the Abbey Thelema. Okay? The Abbey Thelema. And in the Abbey Thelema, which is a mockery of the whole idea of a Catholic church and so on, in the Abbey Thelema, they just have one law. Do what you will. And so that's what the Hellfire Club wrote above their hideout. And the Abbey Thelema, for those who have studied Crowley, well, actually Aleister Crowley had a retreat where he performed occult rituals, and he called it the Abbey Thelema. So Benjamin Franklin is a member then of secret societies in America, in England, and in France. These were the three countries that were involved in the Revolutionary War. Okay? And many people find this very, very interesting. And I could talk more about that, but I'm going to move on. So Franklin now in this picture, you've got Bacon as a shadow behind him, and then Franklin overlooking the eastern seaboard. Now you'll notice that there on the eastern seaboard, you've got Boston, New York, Philadelphia, and Baltimore. And just south of Baltimore, in time, would be Washington, D.C. One of the researchers that we interview, a guy named Jim Allison, has a website up, and he talks about these global alignments. And he talks about all of these ancient monuments like Easter Island and the pyramids and so on, and how they're all built in alignment one with another. And he has like a lot of really interesting information. Well, one of the things that he talks about, and we interview him, is the alignment of the Revolutionary War cities in America. And this is actually from his website. We do like a 3D animation in the film, but I wanted to show you what he's got on his site. And up there up north, you've got Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Washington, D.C. And these are all built in a perfect alignment along the eastern seaboard. So the question that we ask, considering that it was Masons who came to this country early on, they were sent by Bacon, and Rosicrucians were sent with them. Now, in Rosicrucianism in a nutshell, the symbol for Rosicrucianism is the rose and the cross. For those who remember Dan Brown's book, The Da Vinci Code, he talks about secret information being sub rosa, beneath the rose. And it's a reference to hidden information, hidden knowledge, secret knowledge. And so the rose represents collectively the mystery religions, the pagan religions, the occult. The cross represents Christianity. And Rosicrucianism is what you get when you combine paganism and Christianity. This is why the Gnostics, for example, you can go to a Rosicrucian website today, you can go to AMORC, the Ancient Mystical Order of the Rose and Cross, online today, look them up, and they will tell you flat out, oh yeah, they embrace ancient Gnosticism, they embrace Christianity, they embrace all these religious traditions. If you read the writings of Sir Francis Bacon, who was a very ardent Rosicrucian, his New Atlantis was called the New Atlantis, the land of the Rosicrucii, the land of the Rosicrucians. Why? Because it is this combination, it's this fusion of paganism and Christianity. That's what it represents. That's why when you read Bacon, so much of the time you'll read Bacon and he's talking about the Lord Jesus Christ and he's talking about the atonement on the cross. And he's talking about all these things that sound very, very Christian. And then he'll go and talk about Pallas Athena and the god Apollo and, you know, all of these other pagan traditions, and they're all blended together. And this makes it very, very difficult. I mean, if you want to, you know, when you're examining American history and you're looking at guys, you know, some people will quote somebody like Benjamin Franklin, and he may have some quotes here and there about prayer and about calling out to God and this kind of thing. But if you don't understand how he could do that, how he could refer to the Bible and then refer to the occult, but Rosicrucianism really explains how that's possible, because it's the embracing of both ideas. If you follow this alignment from, real quick, Washington, Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, and Boston, all the way across the Atlantic Ocean, it leads you to Stonehenge. And so the alignment is built in perfect alignment with Stonehenge. Now, in Rosicrucianism, part of the reason I started to tell you this, they have what is called the Hermetic Maxim. The Hermetic Maxim is, as above, so below. And you will see statues or drawings or paintings or so on. Probably, if any of you have ever seen the Baphomet, okay, which is that goat-headed looking devil thing, sitting cross-legged, right, with a flame above his head. Well, next time you see it, look, and you'll see he's got one hand going like this and another hand going down that way. Okay? And it means, as above, so below. There's even a statue of George Washington that was done. I think it's in the Smithsonian. If I had a picture, I could show you. But you've got Washington sitting there dressed like some Roman god, and he's got one hand up and one hand down. As above, so below. Now, the reason that's important, because that's a very dominant principle and teaching in the occult, is the belief is the reason that the pyramids were built in alignment with the stars is because of that maxim. The reason that they build things in alignment with astrology and things like that is because they're looking to the heavens, that which is above, and they're trying to imitate that which is above down below. And so this would explain why they would build these things in alignment, because the thinking would be, if this was intentional, the thinking would be that the early American cities would be empowered by the same powers that empower Stonehenge. That's the whole reason for doing it, because the Rosicrucian, the occultist, believes if they design a building or a city or whatever in alignment with the stars, that those same gods and goddesses that are above are going to empower you down below. And so they're drawing upon this occult power. So the question is, was this accidental? Is this just a coincidence? Or was this the intentional design of these secret societies who came to America early on? And we pose the question. All right, so here's another quote from Hall. Hall says, "It must be remembered that Bacon did not play a lone hand. He was the head of a secret society, including in its membership the most brilliant intellectuals of his day. All these men were bound together by a common oath to labor in the cause of a world democracy. Bacon's Society of the Unknown Philosophers," that's the reference to the New Atlantis, these wise philosophers who are hidden away and nobody knows who they are. "Bacon's Society of the Unknown Philosophers included men of high rank and broad influence. Together with Bacon, they devised the colonization scheme." Now, what's interesting about this Society of Unknown Philosophers, this leader in the story, the New Atlantis, this leader comes out, and he's the head of, one of the heads of the House of Solomon. And he shares with these Christian sailors what the treasures of the House of Solomon are. And he starts describing what the treasures are. And he starts describing tall buildings and flying machines and submarines and underwater breathing apparatuses. And he's describing sound studios where they have instruments that they can that allow you to speak and to project your voice over a long period or a great distance and so on. He's describing zoos. He's describing experiments upon animals, injecting them with poison to see how they'll respond so that that knowledge can then be used for the benefit of mankind. And he's describing all of these things, most of which did not exist during that era, but things that would be developed through the 19th and the 20th century in America. And this has caused a lot of people to marvel when they read Bacon's work. And many people credit Bacon. I mean, there have been Baconian societies that revere Sir Francis Bacon for hundreds of years. And many of them credit Bacon because of this and because of his influence through these secret groups and his philosophy about what America should become. They credit Bacon as the real and true founder of America. Okay, but notice what Hall says. I want to draw your attention to the last couple of words he puts in there. He says, "Together with Bacon, they devised the colonization scheme." Now, we go to this Newfoundland stamp from 1910. And if you look at the stamp, it's a 6-cent stamp, and you have the image of Sir Francis Bacon on there. And down below it says, "Lord Bacon, the guiding spirit in colonization scheme." So this idea about Bacon, this wasn't just Manly Hall. He wasn't the only guy in the world who believed this. This is 1910. Hall didn't establish PRS until 1934, 35, right around there. I hear somebody whispering 666 over there. Yeah, it's you've got two sixes. I almost didn't want to point it out. I know. There's three. 6 cents and then two sixes up top. In fact, one of the guys that we interview, a guy named Ian Taylor, he's been studying Bacon for years and years. Bacon is a favorite subject matter of esoteric wisdom teachers. Because he was into ciphers and secret codes and all this other kind of stuff, all the stuff that you find in the occult. Bacon was into it, and he had a very romantic approach to it. But it's very interesting that you've got this stamp with... with 666 on it. So I just wanted to recap real quick Bacon before I get to the next section. Bacon became the chief of the Rosicrucian order in England. Now, the way that the Rosicrucians came about in England, I think this is very significant. When Queen Elizabeth I came to the throne, okay, she came to the throne right away, the Pope at the time, Europe was dominantly Catholic. And the government of Europe was you had the Pope, you had the kings, and then you had the people. The Pope ruled over the kings, and the kings ruled over the people. That was the structure of government. Well, when Henry VIII, as we know, established the Anglican Church of England, the Protestant Church, then you had Bloody Mary that came in after he died. Bloody Mary dies, then Elizabeth comes to the throne. Well, the Pope denounced Elizabeth and basically called for her assassination. So you had all of these assassins going out trying to wipe out Elizabeth. Well, the English banded around Queen Elizabeth with Sir Francis Walsingham, and they formed this network, basically an intelligence system. And that intelligence system, according to certain English historians that I'm going to introduce you to here in just a minute, was the early Rosicrucian movement in England. It was founded initially for the purpose of protecting Queen Elizabeth. Okay? Which sounds like a noble thing, but admittedly, the guys who study the Rosicrucians admit that they had an inner agenda, and it was an esoteric agenda. And this is something that guys like Hall and others write about. And their inner agenda was to basically hide themselves within the Protestant movement, the Protestant Christian movement. Why? Because at that time, if you were worshiping like the gods, the muses of Sir Francis Bacon, Apollo and Athena, we show in the documentary he had this headpiece, two A's, a light A and a dark A, the light side and the dark side, the yin and the yang, but for him, it was Apollo, the god Apollo, and then Pallas Athena, his counterpart. Okay? Well, if you made that known openly, whether you were in Catholic Europe or you were in Protestant Europe, they'd throw you in prison and possibly kill you. So this is if you interview these guys, they all say the same thing, that this was the reason that secret societies began. That they began because they had to keep what they really believed secret, and what they really believed were these occult doctrines. Okay, so from Rosicrucianism, Sir Francis Bacon formalized that system, because in Rosicrucianism you have openly the conjuring of demons. The first chief of the Rosicrucian order was a guy named Dr. John Dee that we talk about. Well, Dee was a mentor to Sir Francis Bacon. Dee is an where with Bacon you read his writings and you kind of go back and forth, gee, what am I getting involved in? In Dee, with John Dee, you have a guy who's drawn a pentagram on the floor and summoning demons in no uncertain way. But Dee has been a prototype for a lot of interesting characters in literature. He was the inspiration for Prospero in Shakespeare's Tempest. Some believe he was the inspiration for King Lear. He was the inspiration for Dr. Faustus, Christopher Marlowe's play. In modern times, he was the inspiration for Gandalf from Lord of the Rings, the old wizard. He was the inspiration for Albus Dumbledore in the Harry Potter books, the old magician, who's the professor going around teaching and so on. And he was also, oddly enough, the inspiration for James Bond, 007. When the Rosicrucians were formed, and they formed this intelligence network with secret codes and everything, Dee would sign his correspondence to the Queen, 007. Okay? So that was his signature. And so that's where that comes from. And Ian Fleming got a hold of this, and he developed it, and it ultimately turned into James Bond. But it's believed that Bacon, because Dee handed off the leadership of the Rosicrucians to Sir Francis Bacon. And Sir Francis Bacon became the leader of the Rosicrucians. So he took that system. What I think he did was he got the magical side out of it. Because the Rosicrucians don't have any problem summoning demons at all. They think, hey, these demons have a lot of knowledge. Chances are communing with these spirits and so on is how the Egyptians learned how to build the pyramids, and these ancient societies did great things. Why? Because they gained knowledge from the spirit realm. So they didn't think this was a bad thing, because they were trying to pursue this knowledge supposedly for the benefit of mankind. And this is why Bacon became, I believe, part of the reason why he became known as the father of the modern scientific method. He was the guy who developed the method that would later be adopted by guys like Sir John Locke, Sir Isaac Newton, even Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson considered Francis Bacon one of the three most important men in history. And Jefferson, according to Baconians and others, Jefferson believed that he was fulfilling Bacon's desire for a new Atlantis in founding the United States. Now I want to introduce you to this guy. A lot of our information about Bacon, while there's just hundreds of books that have been written on him, if you know where to look for him, a lot of our information comes from a guy named Peter Dawkins. And Peter Dawkins is an Englishman. He is very much into the New Age, into esoteric wisdom. He's a very nice man, but he's deeply involved in the occult. And Peter Dawkins is the founder and president of an organization called the Francis Bacon Research Trust in England. And it's just outside of Stratford-upon-Avon, in a place called Upper Tyso. And we interview him in Secret Mysteries. You'll see him there. A very eloquent fellow, deeply involved in New Age eschatology and theology and so on. And he tells us that he believed that Sir Francis Bacon was the reincarnation of Elias the artist, meaning Elijah. Why? Because he says Elijah comes every few generations and so on to herald the coming of the Christ. And so he believed that Bacon's job, part of Bacon's job, was to herald the coming of the next Christ. Okay, this was Bacon's job. Now, I'm going to follow that thought here in just a minute. Dawkins' work is supported by this guy. Now, let me tell you how this happened. When I was I actually found Peter Dawkins when I was researching PRS, the Philosophical Research Society, Manly Hall Society. Okay, Dawkins had been invited there to speak on his stuff on Bacon, and of course they love Bacon at PRS because of Manly Hall. Bacon was Manly Hall's favorite subject of all the stuff that he studied. It said that Hall was his favorite topic, and his wife Marie Bauer Hall was completely given over to Baconian philosophy and so on. So I wanted to get into a place called Canonbury Tower, which is in England, and it's where Bacon had lived prior to his death. And it's believed that he began the Invisible College at this place called Canonbury Tower, and that he held a lot of his meetings with the Masons and the Rosicrucians there. Okay? And when you go there, we show, in Secret Mysteries, we show a lot of the original wood carvings that they had, and you see a couple of phoenix heads coming up. There's in the wood, I didn't point it out, but I'm going to sooner or later, the Masonic compass on the wall, and all of these really rich esoteric symbols that are carved into the wood there. Well, Peter Dawkins told me, he said, well, if you want to get permission, contact this woman. Her name was Carol. And so I did. I sent her an email and called and left a message. Well, a couple of days later, I got an email. And the email said, Dear Mr. Pinto, I understand you're trying to gain access to Canterbury Tower for your film. I said, I would love to help you, but you know, I'm going to need some more information, blah, blah, blah. Sincerely, Lord Northampton. So I'm sitting here looking at this email, and I'm thinking, how often do you get an email from a guy named Lord Northampton? So I talked to Peter Dawkins a few days later, and I say, well, I got this email from this guy named Lord Northampton. Do you know who he is? And he says, oh, yes. He says, he's the Marquis de Northampton. And I said, oh, okay, what does that mean? And he said, well, the Marquis de Northampton is known as the pro-grand master of British Freemasonry. Now, let me explain to you what this means, because it took me a while to figure it out. But you can actually find all of this online. The Grand Master of British Freemasonry is this fellow, the Earl of Kent, a member of the royal family. He is the Grand Master of British Freemasonry. He's a cousin to the Queen, Queen Elizabeth, and to the Duke of Edinburgh. Because he is a member of the royal family, as the Grand Master, he can appoint a pro-Grand Master who acts in his place. Okay? Because he's busy being royalty, somebody else makes all of the certain decisions and goes and meets everybody, etc., and so on. So as pro-Grand Master, the Marquis de Northampton, who fulfills that role, is the acting head of all British Freemasonry. And here I say he's arguably the most powerful Mason in the world. Why? Because if you interview Masons, all Masonic lodges that are official Masonic lodges ultimately owe their allegiance to the Grand Lodge of England. That's the centralization of their power source. And the guy who's the head of the Grand Lodge of England is Lord Northampton, the Marquis de Northampton. Now, he's a personal friend of Peter Dawkins, and he supports his work. Dawkins lives in Northampton's country home in Stratford-upon-Avon. Okay? Lord Northampton has authority over Canonbury Tower. Dawkins goes there and teaches at Canonbury Tower. It is now called the Canonbury Masonic Research Center. And they have all of these meetings. People like S. Brent Morris, the managing editor of the Scottish Rite Journal, who was on the History Channel talking about Masonry and so on, has also been to Canonbury Tower giving lectures there and so on in England. A lot of people don't even know this place exists, but it's dedicated to researching the philosophies and the teachings of Masonry. Okay, Northampton is an interesting character. He's said to have an interest in what is called fringe Masonry. Now, if you study fringe Masonry, and this is one of the arguments that the Masons are using right now, fringe Masonry includes characters like Aleister Crowley, who was a high-ranking Mason. Okay, and he was initiated, supposedly, into 90th degree Masonry, the Rite of Mizraim, and so on. Well, the Masons are debating and all sort of kind of stuff about whether or not this is official Masonry or that this is fringe Masonry and so on. And so you can't really blame Crowley on the Masons, this kind of thing. They go back and forth. But it's very interesting that one of Northampton's hobbies is researching fringe Masonry. Some claim, and I haven't been able to get confirmation of this, that he is working on a project that deals with rebuilding Solomon's Temple in Jerusalem. If you study Masonry, if you read Albert Mackey's encyclopedia on Masonry, and you look up Solomon's Temple, he will tell you that the temple in Masonry, that Solomon's Temple in Masonry is the center of all Masonic philosophy and purpose and all this other kind of stuff. It's a very important issue. But again, that's an unconfirmed report. So I try not to make too much of it. So Dawkins has authored some 14 books on Sir Francis Bacon. He teaches also at the Globe Theatre in London, because among the theories that Dawkins espouses and all Baconians espouse is that Sir Francis Bacon was the real author of the Shakespeare plays. Okay, and he had this literary society called the Knights of the Helmet. And they were into the advancement of the English language, and they developed thousands of new words in English, and they really transformed the language. Why? Because they wanted the English-speaking people to be equipped with a good language to go and launch this new Atlantean empire. But what's also very significant about Shakespeare, there are books that some have written, Christian authors, I think very well-meaning, and they talk about all of the biblical references in Shakespeare. And there are many biblical references in Shakespeare. But there are also many pagan references in Shakespeare. You read Macbeth, you read Julius Caesar, you read all of the plays, and you're going to find a mixology of Christian and pagan beliefs. And this is why a researcher in the 19th century, a guy named W.F.C. Wigston, called Shakespeare, quote, Phantom Captain Shakespeare, the Rosicrucian Mask. And we show in the documentary, we show the Droeshout portrait, which is the traditional original portrait of Shakespeare that was done. And you have like a line down the side of Shakespeare's face. And some people believe that it's because it was intended to be a mask, that Shakespeare himself was not the real author of the plays, but that it was Bacon. But anyway, this is one of the things that Dawkins believes. The Globe Theatre, which is the rebuilt version of the old Shakespeare Theater, the Globe Theater, the director there, a guy named Mark Rylance, also embraces Dawkins' teachings. And so Dawkins goes to the Globe Theater, and he teaches them the Masonic and the Rosicrucian symbolism in the Shakespeare plays and Bacon's philosophy that he was trying to unfold in the plays. And many of Dawkins' books deal with that issue. Now, these are two of Peter Dawkins' books. The one on the left I'll draw your attention to first, and this, especially after hearing the previous speakers, Connie and speak earlier. The first book is called Francis Bacon, Herald of the New Age. Now, when I first started studying the New Age years ago, I came across the Time magazine article with Shirley MacLaine. And from what I understand about that article, what Time Magazine said was, well, we don't know where the whole idea of the New Age comes from. And then I kept doing research and ran into Madame Blavatsky and Alice Bailey and Lester Crowley and all these guys. But this is like the earliest reference to the New Age that I've found. According to Dawkins, Francis Bacon called himself the Herald of the New Age. That was a title that Bacon gave to himself. Come to herald the coming of the Christ. Another one of his books that really defines his philosophy is this book, Building Paradise, on the other side. And it's called The Freemasonic and Rosicrucian Six Days Work. The idea is, and Dawkins actually says this in the interview, he says literally that Bacon's whole philosophy was to recover mankind from the fall that he suffered in the Garden of Eden. And that man now, through knowledge, through the tree of knowledge, would be enlightened, and through his enlightened understanding, could then, by his own efforts, build paradise on earth. But this time, he says, paradise will be even better than it was before, because man will have earned it. So Atlantis, myth or history? This is a question that I get quite a bit about Atlantis. Is it a myth or is it a part of history? And one of the things that I point to, I believe, and many researchers believe, that Atlantis is a representation of the antediluvian world. And that's why I want to show you this book. The reason that we see on the History Channel and Discovery Channel and all these different things, all of these references to Atlantis and TV shows and so on that talk about Atlantis, many people point to this book by Ignatius Donnelly. Ignatius Donnelly was a 19th century congressman. Some people have called him the Dan Brown of his generation. Okay, just to put that in perspective. Donnelly wrote this book on Atlantis, and he believed that Atlantis was a very real place. And so he wrote this book, compiling all of this information about Atlantis and what it represented and so on, and he published it. Well, that book has been in print, and it's in print even up to this day. And many people believe that it's because of Donnelly's book that there has been all of this resurgent interest in Atlantis through the 20th century. And Donnelly even has a quote. I want to read this to you. Quote, the story of the deluge plainly refers to the destruction of Atlantis. And of course, he's talking about the flood of Noah, okay? The destruction of the old world in the flood of Noah, often called the deluge. The story of the deluge plainly refers to the destruction of Atlantis, and that it agrees in many important particulars with the account given by Plato. The people destroyed there were the ancient race that had created civilization. They had formerly been in a happy and sinless condition. They had become, in a happy and sinless condition. I think what he's referring to there is the Garden of Eden. I think so. They had become great and wicked. They were destroyed for their sins. They were destroyed by water. So Donnelly is relating the whole Atlantis account to the flood of Noah. Now it becomes very interesting when we go into the New Testament and we read Luke 17, where Jesus says, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be also in the days of the Son of Man. And so it's very interesting, if Atlantis, whether by name or simply by what it symbolizes, if Atlantis was that pre-flood world, and now you've got all these secret societies that are working to rebuild Atlantis, it gives the words of our Lord a very interesting insight, gives us an insight to that scripture, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be also in the days of the Son of Man. And this, I think, is why many researchers believe that the new Atlantis and the new order of the ages and the new world order are all one and the same thing. What does Atlantis mean in the occult? Well, we've been talking about it up to now, but I wanted to draw your attention to a couple of things. The Secret Doctrine by Madame Blavatsky, if you read that book, there's two volumes of it. I used to think there was just one, so I ordered it, and I got these two big fat books in the mail, and I thought, well, why did I get two books? And then I realized there's volume one and volume two. But anyway, the secret doctrine essentially, as it is abbreviated by Trevor Ravenscroft, who's another New Age writer, in his book, The Sphere of Destiny. The secret doctrine, in a nutshell, is the idea of man's evolvement through the ancient world, and that man began in this lower form. And it really, according to Ravenscroft, he goes back to the Nephilim in Genesis 6. The sons of God entering into the daughters of men, and they brought forth giants who were mighty men, men of renown, and so on. And he talks about how this race had developed and evolved over so many centuries, okay, until they arrived at the master race, and that was the Aryan race. Okay? That's believed to be the secret doctrine. So it's by engaging these angelic beings and being involved with them, basically getting involved with demons and being empowered by them, mankind can slowly evolve onward and upward until he reaches this enlightened state. You know, ye shall be as gods, and so on. So Blavatsky is essentially, in all of her rambling, that's basically what she's talking about. And she talks about in The Secret Doctrine how the master race that ruled Atlantis was the Aryan race. Well, who kept a copy of The Secret Doctrine at his bedside? Adolf Hitler. Read this on a regular basis. This comes from Wikipedia. You can get this on the internet. The Nazi belief was that the Aryan race was a master race that built a civilization that dominated the world from Atlantis about 10,000 years ago. And that is identical to the teaching of Manly Hall, who taught that Atlantis was this ancient philosophic empire that extended to all the world. Something that's very interesting. A lot of people have made the parallels between Iran and Nazi Germany. Well, I found out that the name Iran means Land of the Aryans. Okay? You see, the idea of the Aryan is not just like Hitler's idea of it was the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Nordic Superman, right? But that's not the occult idea of it. In fact, Blavatsky relates the Aryans to all the different races and peoples and so on. Okay? And the word Iran, or not the word Iran, but the word Aryan means high and noble one. Okay? That which is high and noble and so on. But the name Iran means land of the Aryans. Is there a connection? When Benjamin Krem was interviewed in Los Angeles, okay, he was asked, you know, because he's always talking about world peace and so on, he went off on this diatribe against Israel and how Israel was an unjust state, okay, that didn't have the right to exist and all this other kind of stuff. But then he was asked about the president of Iran, and how the president of Iran is calling for the annihilation of Israel. And you know what he said? He said, oh, I don't think he means all that. Okay? He was ready to justify the president of Iran. Why? Because the president of Iran has dedicated his presidency to bringing forth the Imamahdi. And for those who don't know, the Imamahdi is the Muslim Messiah. The Imamahdi is supposedly going to show up, wipe out all the enemies of Islam, and bring about this golden age for Islam. That's the Imamahdi. He's very clearly a picture. If you study the Imamahdi, he's a picture of the Antichrist. Well, Krem openly admits that he believes that the Imamahdi and his Maitreya, his Christ, are one and the same. And the president of Iran gave a speech apparently at the United Nations a couple of years ago. And Krem was lauding the speech, and he said, oh, it was such a brilliant speech, and it was so wonderful. He said, you know, I thought it could have come from Maitreya himself. And so he said that he consulted with his master, his spirit guide. I'm not kidding. He consulted with his master because he said some of the president of Iran's followers, when he spoke, they said that they noticed a shimmering light around him. Okay, so Krem consulted with his spirit guide, and his spirit guide told him, yes, that was from Maitreya. And Krem was asked about what he thought it would take to resolve the problems in the Middle East. And his response was, well, Maitreya will have to resolve it. He'll have to step in. And of course, for those who know prophecy, they know about Antichrist coming in to make a peace treaty and so on. It all seems to fit together. I just wanted to finish on a couple more quotes. Secret societies. Hall talks about how all of these secret societies, whether it's the Masons, the Rosicrucians, whoever they are, they're all working together toward this common cause. And he says all these groups belong toward what is called the Order of the Quest. All were searching for one and the same thing. That one thing was a perfected social order, the government of the philosopher king. And this takes us back to the speech given by President Bush when he's talking about when our founders declared a new order of the ages, they were acting on an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled.
When our founders declared a new order of the ages, they were acting on an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled.
What is that ancient hope? I don't know of any journalist anywhere in America who took the time to ask, well, gee, what's this ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled, as though President Bush himself is going to work to fulfill it? Okay? Notice how Paul makes a Manly Hall makes a reference to the government of the philosopher king. The philosopher king is one of the names that you might give to the Antichrist. Now, he says this. He says, quote, a description of the lost Atlantis was written by Plato. It introduces the league formed by the 10 benevolent kings who ruled over the lesser nations, who bound themselves by oath to obey the divine laws of enduring empire. This was the philosophic democracy, with all men having the right to become wise through self-discipline and self-improvement. Now notice how he talks about there being 10 kings, right? 10 benevolent kings that ruled over the lesser nations, and these were all people bound by an oath. You study the secret societies, all of the members of these secret groups, whatever the groups are, they are all initiated into these societies by swearing an oath of some kind. Hall talks about it again. He says, the Critias first describes the blessed state of the Atlantean people under the benevolent rulership of 10 kings who were bound together in a league. Some researchers believe that when the League of Nations was founded, originally, the reason they called it the League of Nations is because they were trying to emulate the Atlantean League of 10 kings. From the fable, we can infer that 10 rulers of the Atlantic League were philosopher kings. And this takes us to Revelation 17. And the 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings, who have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind, and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. Is it possible that this whole idea of the Atlantic League of 10 kings is really what's driving these secret groups, these secret orders? Is this what they're being driven to do? Well, it's interesting because it goes on to say, and the 10 horns which thou sawest, God hath put in their heart to fulfill his will, and to agree, and to give their kingdom unto the beast, until the words of God shall be fulfilled. Now, something that I find really interesting about these 10 kings is that we read in the book of Revelation, as we're reading in chapter 17, it goes on to tell us, these shall make war against the Lamb of God, Jesus Christ. And when you study these secret societies, when you study guys like Albert Pike, and Pike is writing in Morals and Dogma about, he's using this ancient Gnostic name for God, the God of the Bible, Ialdabaoth. Okay? And he's referring to Ialdabaoth as being this lesser God who created Adam and Eve and the earth. Okay? And he goes on to say that it was devils that forbade Adam and Eve to eat from the tree of knowledge. But it was an angel of light, he says, who showed up and gave them permission to be redeemed through the tree of knowledge, the serpent. And you can see throughout Pike's writings in Morals and Dogma and his influence, another guy named Eliphas Levi, who taught, as Madame H.P. Blavatsky taught, this inversion of God and the devil, where God becomes the devil and the devil becomes God. And it is, you know, it's not just a matter of theological opinion. It is hatred against the God of the Bible and hatred against our Lord Jesus Christ. And that's entirely what they mean. I used to think that when the kings write out, because you go to Revelation 19 and you read, you know, it says, "And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him who sat on the horse, Jesus." I used to think, well, you know, they're probably just out fighting and they don't realize they're fighting against Jesus. But the more I've studied these secret societies and what they're doing, the more I'm convicted they know exactly what they're doing. Maybe not all. I can't say all Masons and all Rosicrucians, but many of these guys who are in positions of leadership, they know exactly what they're doing. Dr. Stan, how am I doing on time?
You've got about 3 minutes to wrap up.
Okay. Well, I was going to talk about Krem and the Imamati and this whole deal, but I kind of went over it. Oh, I was going to talk about David Barton and Masonry. You know what? I think I am going to conclude my presentation there. Thank you all. I want to thank Dr. Stan and Radio Liberty. You guys have been great. God bless you. Thank you.